Hey there, it's Gary Parrish. It's Wednesday, June 27, 2018. Welcome back to the Eye on College Basketball Podcast. Got Matt Norlander here with me, and it's been a little while since we last spoke, nearly 2 weeks. We were both bouncing around a lot last week. I was in New York part of the week, Fort Lauderdale part of the week. Norlander was on golf coverage and then actually at Barclays Center for the NBA draft. So we just, I suppose we could have connected, but it would have been very, very difficult. So we apologize if you've been refreshing your Apple Podcast feed over and over again. But we're here now. Norlander, what's up with it?
Hey, bud. Good to be back with you. Not much. Yeah, I did some U.S. Open coverage, which was cool. And then the Travelers Championship, which always takes place after the U.S. Open, is up here in my home state of Connecticut. So I did a back-to-back weekend, some golf, a nice way to switch it up. And then the draft was a lot of fun and also interesting and great to do with CBS Sports HQ, which, by the way, if you are not watching, be sure to watch CBS Sports HQ, 24-hour news network. Parrish did a great job on the draft coverage. I watched as much as I could there, GP, in the midst of actually being there, interviewing players. We had it on like a second screen there, and you guys did a great job as well. But it has been pretty busy just with stuff surrounding it. So, yeah, apologies to the listeners, but it's great to be able to pod again and kind of catch up with plenty of – this is a bit refreshing. Plenty of college basketball news itself outside of even what happened at the draft.
And a lot of it's got to do with Wendell Carter's mother. She's fired up, huh?
Parrish, she's fired up, and this is interesting. So as we record this, I'm about done a column. It'll publish later on. So depending on when you're listening to this, it'll either just be getting about to be published or it'll have long been published if you're catching up on the podcast. But to me, what's intriguing about this is you don't often have people outside of the media, and maybe even within the media a lot, Parrish, really going after Krzyzewski. And I guess if you were to be even more specific about it, going after Krzyzewski's character, which in essence is what Kylia Carter has done here, because she feels as though she was deceived and the family was deceived by Krzyzewski. She told us to NBC Sports Chicago. She said she was, quote, pissed, end quote, once Marvin Bagley III got into the fold at Duke. Because for so long, the idea was that Wendell Carter, who, by the way, was an elite five-star, one-and-done prospect going into Duke, the idea was that he was going to potentially be the focal point of an offense. And then 8-9 months later, Bagley joins the fold. I've got a number of thoughts on this because I think it's interesting, but it's also a little complicated. And I think both sides are sort of validated in their feelings. But what's your reaction, Parrish, when you see the mother of a one-and-done recruit who went to Duke, was a top-7 pick, and then 3-4 months after the college season ends, deciding to say, oh, by the way, you know, I wasn't thrilled about this. I haven't talked to Krzyzewski about this yet, but we're going to get to that at some point, which was also intriguing because it's not as though this was percolating behind the scenes for 6-7 months, Parrish. If we're to take her for her word, she hasn't really even addressed these concerns to Krzyzewski directly. He found out about them, at least most directly, through the media.
Yeah, well, I guess I would say I'm not sure that she, quote, decided to speak up about this now as much as it appears she was asked about it, right? And she's a talker. She seems to be a great talker. And so she was asked about something, and she went, you know, full throttle. I can understand both sides. I think you and I might be in agreement here, and we haven't talked about this at all. I don't even know what your column is going to say, but I could understand being the parent of a five-star big who commits to Duke, enrolls at Duke, and thinks that your son's going to be the primary focus of this and that and whatever, and then, you know, in July, after your son's already enrolled, you find out the best high school prospect in the world is headed to Duke and going to be perhaps not in direct competition with your son, but clearly taking rebound shots, opportunities away from your son in some form. So I get that. But the alternative is what? Like, you're not supposed to take Marvin Bagley if you're Duke? I mean, that's the part I understand Mrs. Carter. Why you might have felt blindsided by this, because on some level, the college basketball world was blindsided by this. You remember, we were I don't know if you were at Peach Jam, but I was at Peach Jam, and that's where I wrote about it from. And I asked Marvin about it and asked his father about it, and, you know, had talked to enough coaches involved in the recruitment to be able to report, like, this is going to happen. And, you know, or at least Marvin Bagley is trying to make it happen. And so I can understand if you're Wendell Carter's mom or Wendell Carter, and you hear about this and you're like, whoa, what? But the alternative to not wrong, if you believe Wendell Carter and or his mother was wronged by this, then the alternative to wronging them was for Duke to what? Not take a commitment from Marvin Bagley? I mean, get out of here. So this is college basketball. This is the way this stuff works. I find it difficult to – I can understand why she might have felt like her son ended up in a situation that they didn't plan for. But I don't know that there's any realistic alternative to that happening.
It's on Mike Krzyzewski and his staff to recruit the best possible players they can get to Duke. And once Marvin Bagley III has a potential to reclassify and get into that group, they have to go after him. It's just the nature of the beast. Now, I think how we get to this point, Parrish, is – and I was speaking with a couple of coaches at you know, high major schools, and one, they say the reclassification game just in general has really muddied the waters even more so, because you are going to have players that are top 15 quality that want to advance their clock so they can get to the NBA sooner. If the timeline allows, if the calendar allows, get to the NBA sooner so they can get one more year in the pros, get that much more money, get to it quicker. So that has been a dynamic that has been added into the fold, particularly within the past 5 years, that really wasn't there at all 20 years ago, let alone 10, 12 years ago. So that's part of it. But in trying to understand where the Carter family is coming from this, we don't know what exactly was promised by Krzyzewski and his staff, but certain things get promised, particularly if you were a top 10 recruit. Okay, there are just certain things that you're going to go in there and you're going to sell in order to land a player of Wendell Carter Jr.'s ability. And even though he was overshadowed by Marvin Bagley III at Duke, I want to remind people that he was an awesome, awesome prospect. And had Bagley never gone to Duke, there would have been a lot of anticipation and expectation of him not to necessarily be as good as Bagley was. I don't think it was that high, but absolutely to be a potential All-American type of player. And then Bagley gets there, all the press is for him, and what will Grayson Allen do? And yes, Wendell Carter Jr. was absolutely overshadowed by Bagley. But so we don't know what Duke promised to the family. And then let's say they promise A, B, C, D, and G, okay? Forget about F. And then Bagley gets into the fold, and they're seeing from afar your reports from the Peach Jam last year, Parrish. They're seeing clearly, you know, adamant recruiting and a lot of activation on behalf of Krzyzewski to get this done. And then after it gets done, as I note in the column, Krzyzewski even says, you know, we were confident that he was going to be cleared in this process, indicating that for at least a couple months' time, they had designs and they had their sights on getting him reclassified. So if you're the Carter family, you're thinking, well, wait a minute, like, you went through this with us for a year and a half, 2 years. You told us all of these things, and now someone better has just come along? Now, the flip side to that, obviously, is, well, yeah. I mean, at a certain point, you got to know who you are and where you stand, and this is sometimes the uncomfortable reality. And as I also note, this is commonplace at the top programs, and you'll find it in the lowest levels of Division III basketball, where you simply will have parents that you cannot appease. There are too many roster spots, too little playing time, only a certain number of guys can get the ball, get their touches, get their shots. You can never please everybody, but what's unusual about this is, one, it's Duke, and two, you don't normally have people going after Krzyzewski in this kind of way. I don't expect him to respond to this publicly, Parrish, because it doesn't serve him well to do so. But at the same time, yes, she was asked about it, so she spoke up about it. She could have simply said something along the lines of,
oh, sure,
it didn't go the way we wanted it to go, but I'll tell you what, my son, even though he was not afforded the opportunities we thought initially, he was benefited by playing alongside Marvin, and he ended up being a top. Like, she could have taken a different lane than she took, and now those recruiting against Krzyzewski, even though it might not prove to be successful, they can use some of this against him in recruits for 2019 and 2020.
No question. Wendell Carter, I think the timeline is important. He committed to Duke in November 2016, and at that time, I guess Marvin Bagley was a sophomore in high school?
Don't try and make me figure that out.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, he would have been a sophomore in high school. And so I do think that the Duke staff knew well in advance. I don't know about well in advance, but knew before July. I would say they knew no later than June of 2017. That, yeah, by the way, Bagley would have been a junior in high school. He'd have just started. He'd been in November of his junior year. So I would say they knew probably at least by June of 2017, June of last year, that Bagley was going to reclassify. And I actually wouldn't be surprised if they were, if it was their idea and if they, you know, worked hand in hand with them in whatever form to try to get the best opportunity to do it, to try to make sure he understood what needed to be done to do it. Right. So I guess my point being this, when I report Marvin Bagley is reclassifying, the Duke staff wasn't like, oh, wow, really? Like, they knew. All the staffs involved in the recruitment knew, but I'm not sure they knew back in November, 2016 when Wendell Carter committed. And so at the time they were telling him whatever it is they told him, it was probably all true. And then, as tends to happen in life, things change. And again, if you have an opportunity to enroll the player most people believed was the best high school prospect in the world, I don't know how you turn that down because of promises you made to Wendell Carter in November 2016. Or maybe not, and they might not even be promises as much as they're just like you're framing a possibility in a certain way that doesn't end up being reality. Where I do think a mother of a prospect would have a right to be upset is if something like this went down. Let's say Wendell Carter and DeAndre Ayton are in the same class, and they've always been in the same class. They're always set to enter college the same year. And, you know, Duke is recruiting Wendell Carter, and they're telling him all these things, and they go to the mother, and the mother says, okay, listen, but we want to be the star of the front court. We want to get all the touches. We want things to run through us. DeAndre Ayton is still uncommitted. And they say, listen, we're not recruiting DeAndre Ayton. You don't have to worry about DeAndre Ayton being on our campus. You know, he might go to Arizona. He might go to wherever, but he's not going to be at Duke. So you don't have to worry about that. And then they go out and sign DeAndre Ayton after they sign Wendell Carter. I think that's dirty business. Because that's, you're absolutely you're lying to somebody. But I'm confident when Wendell Carter committed to Duke and signed with Duke, there was never any conversations about Marvin Bagley because nobody thought Marvin Bagley at that time was going to be in college the same year Wendell Carter was going to be. It was supposed to be Wendell Carter 1 year, and then if you get Marvin Bagley, Marvin Bagley the next. Again, at the time Wendell Carter committed. So, like, I don't – like, this isn't the one where I think you can be up in arms. I can understand why you might be frustrated if you're Wendell Carter's mother. She's a mother. You know, it's her child, but if this is supposed to be the, Coach K and his staff have been exposed moment, I think it falls well short of that.
I do as well. And then just to wrap it up here, ultimately, while Carter might not have gotten quite as many minutes as the family would have thought, I mean, he was, I think, fourth or fifth on the team in minutes, but he still had really good production, but he wasn't an all ACC player and all of that. Still winds up going seventh overall, goes to a better franchise than Marvin, doesn't make as much money, sure. You know, it could have gone, I guess, much worse for him, and the fact that it didn't speaks to, obviously, you know, his ability, no doubt about that, but, you know, how he was coached and everything. So the family is fine overall. I think they would admit that as well, but clearly the fact that she is taking this route speaks to how much it still bothered her just a little bit, the how it transpired. But I have a hard time bringing any sort of fault to the Duke staff here, short of something we are not aware of in terms of promises made. But I'm with you 100%, Parrish. I just don't think in November 2016, when he commits, the Duke staff, even in the back of their mind, thinks there's a chance that Marvin Bagley III is going to be in the same class as Wendell Carter Jr. So how can you fault him for that? And then once it becomes a possibility, yeah, it's their duty to try and get him on campus as best they can. Obviously, they succeeded at that. And then now Krzyzewski can boast two top seven picks instead of having just one.
Sure. If you tell me, or if Mrs. Carter would have said, listen, we talked to them in November 2016 before Wendell committed. about Marvin Bagley because we knew there was a chance he'd reclassify. And they told us they were not going to enroll Marvin Bagley or that Marvin wasn't going to be the same year as Wendell. And then in July, we find out that that's not going to be the case. Then I'm like, okay, I understand. Like, I'd be pissed too. And now I'm ready to write the column. Like, that's wrong. You know, but if they never talked about Marvin Bagley and there was never any real indication in November 2016 that Marvin Bagley was going to enroll at Duke to play in the 2017-18 season, then I don't. You know, the world changed. Marvin Bagley decided to reclassify. He became available. Duke would have been idiotic to not accept his commitment. And either way, the bottom line, like you said, is, you know, Wendell Carter went to a school that right there with Kentucky provides the biggest stage college basketball can provide. He played on a top five team and he was a top seven pick. Like, life's pretty good, you know, like things worked out okay. Imagine being Marquise Bolden's parents. Those are the ones that ought to be furious.
And he's still on the team, by the way. Like, and now you got Krzyzewski talking about how he's going to be an improved big man. You make a great point. I have a quick line in that column, Parrish, about just other players on the team and what must their fan. Like, this is just part of the whole deal. And yeah,
to be clear, Wendell Carter is not like who I'm talking about when I make this point. But it's why I've said, like, if you're you know, if you're ranked 65th in the country, you got to be a maniac to go to Kentucky or Duke. Like, what are you? You're never going to get on the court. I mean, they're going to recruit players better than you every single year. I don't want to say you'll never get on the court. Anything's possible, but the odds of it aren't good. More likely than not, you're going to go there, sit on the bench for 2 years and transfer. And so when you enroll at a place like Duke or Kentucky, and it might just be those two places, you have to be very aware that there is a decent chance, almost regardless of who you are, they might get somebody better than you because they're stacking the top two recruiting classes in America with five stars every single year.
Yeah, no doubt about it. It will be interesting to see what other fallout, if any, comes from this, but it's unusual. And even though we got the July recruiting period just around the corner, for Krzyzewski and Duke, I guess it's well-timed in that we're so far removed from the end of the college basketball season and still so far in the distance is the next one. We wait and see, but that was certainly an unexpected headline that popped up early this week.
You mentioned Coach K said about Bolden that he'll be one of the best big men in the country this year. You buying that?
Not a chance.
I don't think so either.
A year ago, I mean, listen,
like, who are we to argue with Coach K? He sees Marquise Bolden every day, right? But like, you know, I don't want to say after 2 years of college you are what you are because that seems absurd, but I never seen anything actually on the court that made me think, you know, Bolden just needs a breakthrough year.
Yeah. If Bolden winds up being a breakthrough player, listen, you or I will write a column on it. That'll be great. I'll just, you know, if I'm giving an honest assessment, he is as lost on defense from a big man perspective as really any former five-star big man I can recall in the past 3 or 4 years. I mean, just completely out of his element there. He's got to vastly improve that. And obviously Duke is bringing in, you know, the assembly line is just a conveyor belt. More and more dudes. So I don't know. We'll see about that. If Duke is going to be a top-five team again next season, I don't believe that Bolden being the best big man is going to be part of that equation or a top-five big man in the country. We wait and see.
So one thing that has happened since we last spoke, and this is more of an indication of when we last spoke than anything else, Reed Travis committed to Kentucky, and I moved Kentucky to number one in the CBS Sports top 25 and one. And while I understand that it is debatable, I guess, if only because this stuff is all debatable, it seems pretty clear cut to me. You know, they now have, you know, that I think necessary combination of experienced, relevant talent and five-star freshmen that John Calipari's best teams have usually included. And while I still think Kansas is going to be great and Duke's got a chance to be great and Nevada is obviously stacked and a legitimate Final Four contender, once I looked at it player by player, it seemed clear to me that Kentucky is the clear-cut number one preseason team. Is it that clear to you?
Taking into account who Kentucky brings back and measuring that up against what Kansas has coming via transfers, recruits, because Kansas was your number one team. And if you want to include, you know, Duke and Nevada, potentially Gonzaga in that, it is probably the most practical decision to put Kentucky at number one heading into next season because of Reed Travis's inclusion. Reed Travis has been a really good player for Stanford, and he's a classic example, in my opinion, Parrish, of a dude who is borderline terrific as a college player, but the skill set he has is not going to translate into any kind of successful NBA career. But at the college level, and particularly as a graduate transfer, someone who's, you know, 6'7", maybe 6'8", and a bulky 250, really good rebounder, pretty good shot selection from this guy. Stanford hasn't been that relevant, Parrish, but I've watched, particularly because of Reed Travis. In fact, I feel like last year, the year before, I was especially high on him when we were doing our top 101 player rankings, because I believe that he's a fantastic college player and is the right kind of inclusion for this Kentucky team in terms of what it could really use down low. Now, in bringing in a grad transfer, we're going to have another quirk to Cal has basically run the gamut on different kinds of lineups and how and roster assembly and what he has done over a near decade at Kentucky. So you sent out the text, I don't know, a week ago or whenever it was, and just kind of saying, like, I'm trying to justify putting Kentucky one or not, and there is really nothing against it. Like, with everything they have, it's reasonable. Parrish, I don't like agreeing with you because I'd like to actually debate you on this, but with Travis going to Kentucky entering the season, I like their personnel better than I like Kansas, who was at number one prior to this.
Right. I mean, the way it breaks down is they've obviously got an amazing recruiting class highlighted by the number one point guard in America once he reclassified, Ashton Hagans. And then, you know, this is the key. I think they're going to start probably three non-freshmen, or at least three of the top six players are going to be non-freshmen. You know, PJ Washington, Quade Green, and then Reed Travis, who's like a 22-year-old man. And it's not just important to have older guys. Like, older guys, like, sitting at the end of your bench don't really matter. But having a 22-year-old who is super productive, in your starting lineup is a big deal for Kentucky. That's not something that they've had. And when you look back at what I consider to be the best Kentucky teams that John Calipari's had, 2010, 2012, 2015, they've all had, and we've talked about this before, roster balance. Not just the five-star freshman, because all of his teams have had that, but either sophomores, juniors, or seniors that are also in the rotation and also relevant players. And this 2018-19 team projects the same way. So, yeah, like, I was hesitant to do it just because, you know, you always have to hear from everybody who's not a Kentucky fan. Oh, Kentucky, number one again. How'd that work out for you? Because if they are number one in the AP poll in October, it will be the third time in a 6-year span that they have started the season ranked number one. And obviously in that 6-year span, there has been, in the previous 5 years, there has been no national championship. And so, you have to be aware of that. And yet, just like with any other rankings, what you do is look at the other options. And when I started breaking down Kentucky's roster and comparing it to Kansas's roster or anybody else's roster, it seemed obvious to me. Doesn't mean Kentucky will be the best team, but on paper, they look like they should be the best team. And the updated odds from Las Vegas bookmakers do show that Kentucky is now the favorite to win the national championship, which I guess can take us into a column I wrote yesterday. John Clay, who's been a columnist at the Lexington Herald Leader for a long, long time, sort of posed the question on Twitter this weekend, and then also, wrote a column about it. Like, should John Calipari have more than one national championship? And his answer, if you just have to do yes or no, is the same answer I would have. Yes, of course he should. But when you dive into it, it requires you to, you know, when you look at John's 9 years at Kentucky, it requires you to sort of balance a, you know, championship or bust mentality with, even if you think he should have more championships, he's still arguably been the most successful college basketball coach over the past 9 years in the entire country. He's been to 4 Final Fours in a 9-year stretch. That's twice as many as anybody else. But there is the only championship. But one of the things I did was go back and look at all the times John either had what I consider to be the nation's best team, or for whatever reason found himself in a great spot to win a national championship. And I think what I found is that 6 times in the past 13 years, he's had either the best team or an awesome shot, realistic shot to win the national title. You go back to 2006, he's at Memphis. Memphis is a 1 seed. They're playing UCLA in the Elite Eight. If he beats UCLA, a team that they had already beaten once earlier in the season, then they're in the Final Four. And while I don't know that they would have won it, they would have been the only 1 seed at that Final Four. That's the Final Four that George Mason made. Florida, everybody remembers winning back-to-back titles and was great and loaded, but Florida was a 3 seed in that NCAA tournament. So there's one. 2008, obviously, they're up 9 with 158 to play. If Mario if they don't collapse and then Chalmers doesn't hit that shot, that's a national championship. 2010, I think he had the best team. John Wall, DeMarcus Cousins, Patrick Patterson, all those guys, Eric Bledsoe. 2012, he actually did win it. 2015, I think he had the best team. He did have the best team. They finished 38-1, but lost to Wisconsin in the Final Four. And then in 2014, nobody thinks that Kentucky team was great, but they were in the championship game and a 2.5-point favorite over UConn at tip-off. And they lost 60-54 or something like that. So, like, that's 6 different times where, like, he could have got one. And he only got one. And if he doesn't get one this year, you know, that bullet point will be what it is. And that conversation will intensify. But I sort of bottom line the column this way. All you can do, or all you can reasonably expect a college basketball coach to do, is assemble a championship contender as often as possible. Get as high a seed as you can in the NCAA tournament, which makes advancing deep more likely than not, and then just hope for the best. And that's the nature of the NCAA tournament. It's a single elimination tournament featuring 68 schools and 40-minute games. Like, no coach, I don't care how good your team is ever likely to win the championship when the tournament starts. And that's just not true in the NBA. Not true, you know, in the NFL. Not true in a whole bunch of sports. But it's absolutely true in college basketball. And so the point I make is you can focus on the missed opportunities, but that's way better than a lack of opportunities. And I would and with John Calipari, you're never going to lack opportunities. He's going to give himself a shot. On average at Kentucky, it's been about every other year, a realistic shot to win a championship. And eventually he'll add more to him. I think just because he's given himself great shots basically every season.
If you were to recalibrate the question and say, when John Calipari got to Kentucky in 2009, you know, broadly speaking, what was the expectation of John Calipari? And if you take that versus where we are now, Parrish, has he exceeded those expectations? My answer is yes, absolutely. Even with only one national title, the Final Fours mean a lot. Making a Final Four, college basketball is fun in part because, yes, winning the title means everything, but there are different tiers that are, I guess, established. Like, if you get to a Final Four, it's its own mini championship in a way, and for some programs, it practically is one. You know, for VCU and George Mason and Wichita State, that's essentially winning a national championship. For a lot of programs, making the NCAA tournament in itself, or if you get to a Sweet 16, that's why I love March. That's why I love the tournament, and college basketball has so much diversity with its expectations among different kinds of programs. Now, at Kentucky, obviously, winning it all is a league apart, and you need to be winning more in the eyes of the fan base than what Cal has done. But from every single, I think the stat is this, I heard it draft day last week. I think every single player that decided to leave after his freshman year at Kentucky, and if you know, if this is wrong, correct me, or if someone listening, but I thought I heard this. Every single one-and-done player at Kentucky has been a first-round pick, okay? So if you were able to take every single player to come out of your program, decide to leave after the first year, and he's going to be a top 30 pick, and I would guess more than half of those are, in fact, lottery picks, huge success, and put more guys into the NBA than anyone else during his time since he got to Kentucky. Big-time success. Making those Final Fours, huge success. Should he have more than one title at this point? Yeah, I guess, but winning a title is just so hard to do. And I do think that the fan base, even though I can't speak for them directly, I think they are satisfied with what Cal has done, perhaps frustrated here or there, but they do have, for as fanatical as Kentucky fans can be, I do think they have a solid grasp on just how fickle the tournament is and how it can be a random results generator so often, and how Kentucky has won in spite of that many times and made the Final Four in certain years where it didn't have the team that proved worthy of that leading into the tournament. And sure, there have been a couple of years, most notably 2009-2010, where they fell short of it, even though they should not have done that. Cal overall, you mentioned bullet point. This might be unfairly building itself to being a gorilla stat type of deal here because he's won one. Like, it's not like he hasn't done it. He's actually done it, and he's the only coach potentially because of how he speaks with the media, how he carries himself, boasts about Kentucky. He's the only coach where we put this expectation on one's not good enough. You need to have more than one. This is not going to cut it. It's an interesting dynamic that I don't think exists anywhere else in sports. The only other thing that I think even comes close, and it's not even close, is not even a team sport. Like, Dustin Johnson is considered by many people to be the most talented golfer out there. He only has one major at this point. He's 32 years old. And yeah, that's right. I'm bringing in some golf coverage because I've had it on my mind the past week and a half, Parrish. But legitimately, there's confusion over the fact that, like, how is this guy this good? He's got, you know, 20 PGA Tour wins at this point. And oddly, he only has one major. It makes no sense whatsoever. Well, with Cal, it's kind of similar. He gets so many one-and-done wins, annually a top two recruiting class, annually in the top five in the preseason polls, nearly annually is winning the SEC and getting really good seeding heading into the tournament in most years, and yet there's only one national championship to speak for it. If he doesn't get that second one, I think that's just going to be a part of, like, his overall story as a coach, but particularly at Kentucky. You know, he changed the recruiting game. Those teams were really good. He had some all-time great teams, but weirdly, at the end of his career, he only had one, which I'll ask you this now. We don't know how much longer he's going to coach, right? I remember famously his first season, Parrish, he said, I'm not going to last more than a decade at Kentucky. Didn't necessarily believe in that moment. I don't believe it now because that means he'd have only one more year there. But whether his career at Kentucky is another two seasons or another 12, over under 0.5 national championships for John Calipari at Kentucky, what are you taking?
I would go over. I think he'll get another one.
I do too.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a little bit like, getting in a batter's box or throwing darts. Like, if you have 10 darts, you're going to get a bullseye eventually, right? I mean, if you're a professional,
professional? I think they're dart players. I don't think they're called, like, darters.
What are they called? What's a professional dart player called?
Just that, I think.
Just a dart player? That sounds so ridiculous. I'm a dart player.
Well, you're a professional basketball player. You're a professional baseball player. Why would it be any other thing?
It feels like it should be a darter.
Like a bowler? Okay.
Yeah, like I'm a darter. So what do you do? I'm a professional darter. That's what it sounds like it should be, but I know it's not. No, they're just, I just Googled it. It's just professional darts with an S player.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so if you're a professional darts player, you might only need one dart. So, but, like, you get the point. Like, if you give how about lottery tickets? If you buy 10, you're more likely to hit something than if you buy one. John's got a lottery ticket every year because he's got lottery picks basically every year. You know, you just keep giving yourself opportunities. The ball will bounce your way eventually. And it already has once. He's got that 2012 title. And you're exactly right. You know, he's not dealing with the stuff Sean Miller's dealing with or Tony Bennett, I guess, to a lesser degree. Like, yo, you know, like, when are you going to – I guess they're still dealing with the get to the Final Four thing, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, he is probably the only coach where – simply having one is deemed by some to be unacceptable. Although I wonder, is Bill Self starting to run into this a little bit at Kansas?
Maybe, but I only think that's within – see, it's weird, Parrish. I think maybe, but that's only within the fan base and nationally and outside of Kansas. He's accepted as a good coach. And listen, winning all those Big 12 championships, maybe there should be something against that. Whereas with Kentucky, it's more outside in. More national people and people outside the fan base are – now, don't get me wrong. Like, obviously, Kentucky fans think that with all the talent they have, they should have had more than one. But I don't feel like the fan base is – pinning Cal against the wall and starting to get sick of this that he doesn't have more than one. It just doesn't feel like there's even any smells of a mutiny brewing inside of that fan base overall, whereas Kansas is probably just as thrilled to have Self there. They're a little more like, what the hell, man? Like, how are we not getting closer? And part of that is, by the way, Self has been there longer than Cal and still has fewer Final Four trips at Kansas than Cal has at Kentucky.
Right. I think the other thing you have to, like, if you're going to say John Calipari should have won more championships in his 9 years at Kentucky, then you have to ask the question, well, who has actually done more? And I believe it's only two guys. Mike Krzyzewski has two in that span. He won in 2010 and then won again in 2015. And then Jay Wright obviously has won two in that span. But I think that's it. Yeah. So when you've been to twice as many Final Fours as anybody else in the past 9 years, and only two people have won more championships than you, like, that's pretty damn good. I guess I'd bottom line it this way. I don't think even Kentucky fans, who I think some can acknowledge are sometimes irrational, I think even Kentucky fans are smart. I shouldn't say that, but like, I think even Kentucky fans realize they couldn't have anybody better. Nobody. It's unreasonable to think that anybody else in that job could do that job any better than the way John's done it. And if you set a championship or bust mentality, apply it to literally any coach or any program in college basketball, you are setting yourself up to be disappointed. That's a failing proposition every single time. You know, in college football with Nick Saban in Alabama, it's not. But in college basketball, with any coach in any program, that just can't be where the pass-fail line is. If it is, everybody's going to fail, way more often than they pass.
Well, how about this? Let's transition to our final topic here, because there is a coach who has a national championship who is still considered a failure, a recent coach, and his situation overall doesn't have many, if any, parallels, Parrish, and that's obviously Kevin Ollie at UConn, former UConn coach, and his legacy at that school gets more complicated by the month, because he goes from, you know, obviously NBA caliber player at the university to playing and being a journeyman in the NBA, and someone who, coming into the college coaching scene, Parrish, had a really good reputation as sort of as a soothsayer on the player level. In the pros, he famously was a mentor to Kevin Durant. He goes to the UConn bench and becomes Calhoun's next guy. Like, that's the guy Calhoun wanted to take over the program. He does that, wins the title. Sure, with a lot of the guys that Calhoun recruited, I don't care, wins a title nonetheless, and then it goes south from there. He gets canned. Now he's in the middle of this lawsuit, and now we find out more and more that the things UConn is pinning on him and the reasons why it doesn't want to pay him a buyout in the neighborhood of $10 million, the accusations vary, but to you, Parrish, there's one in particular. Like, you made a good point right before we started this podcast. Like, some of the stuff I get is a little petty, but in your eyes, there is one in particular that UConn has a leg to stand on and is potentially valid and might wind up helping UConn, if not win its case, certainly go a long way to not paying them a lot of money. From your perspective, which aspect of the rules violations, alleged ones, do you think that is?
Right. Well, first things first, let me just state, I think it's hilarious that the school that stood by Jim Calhoun is now trying to fire,
yes,
Kevin Ollie for calls. Like, get out of my face. And I know it's different people in different circumstances, but like, come on. If Kevin Ollie was still winning enough, he would still have his job. None of this stuff would be an issue. None of it. So I think that's important to note. Like, you know, UConn might legally get over on him, but like, nobody thinks this is, you know, Kevin Ollie is not, how about this? If Kevin Ollie had gone to the Final Four last year, but also been found to have committed major violations, he would still be the head coach at UConn. Not even a discussion. He didn't get fired because of he was running a rogue program or committing major violations. He got fired because he took one of the most successful programs of the past few decades and turned it into absolute crap. Like, it, you know, as much time as, you know, I spent over the past year in my hometown talking about Memphis basketball should never look this way, like, it was even more true with UConn. Like, UConn is a level above Memphis historically, and UConn was a level below Memphis in this. It's like incredible. Like, you know, that program should never get to where it got to. And I know injuries played a part, but whatever. UConn should never be as bad. That's why Kevin Ollie's not the coach. But there is language in the contract, if I read it correctly, that says he can be fired for cause, and it doesn't say major violations. Like, I think it just says for rule, you know, breaking rules. Like, unless I read it incorrectly, it doesn't stipulate that it's got to be some major violation. It's just like, you know, if you're found to have broken rules, we can terminate the contract. And so I think UConn might have a legal way to get this done. But there is one allegation that would be a major rules violation. And it comes from, I think, a former assistant.
Yeah.
But there's a whole bunch Glenn of allegations. Miller. But the allegation specifically is this, that Kevin Ollie had a buddy who was a trainer, and he would work out UConn players for free, both in stores, but then also in Atlanta, and that UConn players went to Atlanta to work out with him, and they stayed for free, and they ate for free. And that's all, like, I mean, that's, you know, regardless of how you feel about the NCAA rulebook, that is not allowed, not even close in the NCAA rulebook. And if they can, you know, find that, what's wild is by trying to not pay Kevin Ollie, they are actually like investigating themselves for the NCAA. Like they could end up like getting put on probation again or a postseason ban based on they're trying to save millions of dollars here. But if that can be substantiated in some way, I mean, that's a major violation, and it'll never be the reason he was fired, but it might be the reason he don't get his money.
Yeah, UConn's approach from this parish. Yeah, absolutely. And I'll get to the workout thing in just a second. But from UConn's perspective, my understanding is this. They're going to go this route because if they uncover this kind of stuff, the NCAA is then going to afford the university leniency because UConn will then say, we uncovered this mid-season, notified you. You've been – the NCAA has quasi been working hand-in-hand with UConn on this, got rid of Ollie, got rid of the entire staff, and hopefully absolve itself, Parrish, of any significant NCAA sanctions to come forward. That's what their approach is. If it doesn't go that way, it would be one of the more hilarious backfires ever. We wait and see on that. And as for the workouts, you know, you can just say, oh, it's just workouts, whatever. Well, there is a big-time difference between having a guy – sneaking some workouts on campus here and there, which relatively minor in my opinion. I don't care about that. But if you've got players hopping on planes, going hundreds of miles to work out, there's just not a big difference between from the in the NCAA's eyes, there's just not a big difference between that and Bob McKillop using Steph Curry and saying, yeah, listen, I'm going to take my guys. They're going to work out with Steph or Steph's main guy. That can be a major recruiting advantage.
And hey, I'll take it a step further. Steph's going to fly my guys out to California.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, that's what this is.
Unquestionably. So that's why the line is drawn there. And it's a fair line to draw because things can spiral totally out of control with benefits afforded, and that's why these things need to be kept in check. So if in particular those allegations are in fact true, I think it's a huge ding against Ollie, who's, you know, obviously doing his damnedest to get all of his money. And the one thing I don't know yet is how long this is going to take to sort out and how much of this is going to linger over the first year, if not longer, of Dan Hurley's tenure at UConn. It'll just be something that is part of the coverage of that program, not necessarily that team. And rest assured, you know, I live up here in Connecticut and the local media does its diligence. This is not going to be something that goes away and we don't hear it about again until the case is resolved. There will be multiple headlines, which will then be talked about in national forums, just as on this podcast, whether we write up about it on the site or many other sites that do that. I think the workouts is the biggest thing. It's the one key thing. And Glenn Miller, the former assistant, who now, by the way, works for Jim Calhoun at a Division III university up in Hartford. They are literally started a men's basketball program that starts this season. His involvement there, his accusations have wound up being key. What I also do not know at this stage is how much he is willing to cooperate from here on out, given that he is still in college athletics and whether that can be held over him against him or not. But clearly that is a bridge that was just straight up torched. And in retrospect, Parrish, it's weird because both of those are Ollie's guys. They were shared a staff. Glenn Miller didn't get promoted to the head coaching job. And how much was there a schism there? It just seems to be a relationship beyond repair. And so UConn absolutely is in the midst of plenty of drama off the court. And I don't think this is something that we're going to get resolution on before the start of the season.
I've been so distracted this entire podcast.
You watching some World Cup right now?
My Mexican brothers, I've been having to sit here talk about basketball while my Mexican brothers are getting their brains beat in. And did you just see this, and this won't be great for the podcast, but we're just talking. Did you just see this in the Germany-South Korea game?
Well, one, no, but two, I'm actually of Swedish heritage, so I'm all good with this Sweden romping Mexico, just for the record. But no, I did not see, I don't have the TVs on in my office here.
I'm Mexican heritage,
no,
Norland.
Stop. Your last name is Parrish.
Dude, my grandfather, rest his soul, is Antonio Cerros.
I mean,
I'm Mexican heritage.
I honestly don't know if you're telling the truth right
now. No, I swear to God. I didn't grow up in Mexico, but my great grandparents did. Absolutely. My grandfather was born in Southern California. His parents were from Mexico. That's a true story.
Well, then my condolences on my Swedish boys kicking.
South Korea just scored on Germany.
That's awesome.
And Germany is going to be eliminated.
Oh, my gosh. Which, by the way, listen, I'm not like a soccer expert, but this is kind of, honestly, it's kind of equivalent to like Kentucky losing in like a 2-15 situation in the first round of the tournament. A lot of people thought Germany would win this thing again. It's crazy.
No, like, this is bananas what we're just watching here. So, South Korea scores in extra time, but it's called offsides, and they have to go review it, and it gets overturned to a good goal. So the place is going bananas. But meanwhile, my Mexican brothers, it's tough, Norlander.
But they're advancing anyway, are they not, even with this loss?
I believe they advance anyway now, yes. How about this? So we had Grandparents Day, just to prove my story is true, but just trust me, all of this is true. We got Grandparents Day when I'm a kid, like kindergarten, right? My whole time, I thought my grandfather was from Mexico. I thought my grandfather was Mexican. And so we go to Grandparents Day, and he's there. And the teacher's like, Gary, introduce your grandfather. And I said, this is my granddaddy and Tony Cerros. And they said, well, what do you want your grandfather to talk to the class about? And I said, granddaddy, just tell him about what it was like growing up in Mexico. He was like, I didn't grow up in Mexico. I was like, damn it. Yeah, I said, okay, well, like, tell him what it was like in Mexico. He's like, I've never been to Mexico. But like for the first 6 years of my life, I thought my grandfather was like legit Mexican. And it turns out he was just from California. Never been more disappointed in him.
Parrish.
True story.
Well, I learned something about you because I never would have possibly imagine that this is part of your heritage.
But can't believe you questioned my Mexican heritage. Yeah, it looks like Sweden and Mexico are going to get through now. I love this World Cup stuff, by the way.
Yeah, it's a good time, man. It's awesome. It's just
like the idea that it's on in the afternoons is awesome.
Yeah. Day sports like in general during the week is fantastic. Yeah.
Awesome. Like I've been, yesterday was awesome with Argentina and Diego Maradona and the double bird. Yeah. And, yeah, I wish we could have the World Cup for the rest of the summer since the Mets suck and I don't have anything to watch.
Yeah, you know, the World Cup, we got to wrap up here, but I believe the World Cup final takes place the Sunday of the Peach Jam, so we'll be back home for that.
What?
So you won't miss the actual final.
I'm coming home Saturday.
Well, yeah, you're that's what I'm saying. Saturday? No, I'm saying, like, we'll be home for that. We won't miss it.
Gotcha. Yeah. All right, good. That's good news. But, well, there's the soccer update at the end of a college basketball podcast.
Thank you for listening.
Yeah, thank you for putting up with this. The Koreans just scored again, Norlander.
Amazing.
They're humiliating the Germans.
Wow.
I have to text my German exchange student. She's probably heartbroken right now. Drunk and heartbroken in Berlin.
True. Ugh, all right, tell them how to subscribe.
What a day. Shouts to Devin Downey. Shouts to Chester, South Carolina. Shouts to Terry M.F. and Teagle. He's a legend. And remember to go subscribe to the Island College Basketball Podcast via Apple Podcast. Rate it favorably. That means 5 stars and nice comments. Treat us like an excellent Uber driver, except you don't have to tip. Just 5 stars and nice comments. That's all we ask. And we will talk to you again, I guess, next week. Till then, take care.